Hey there! Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I am your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I am a current college professor, and I'm passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so each week on this podcast, I share strategies and blueprints and ideas. I tell stories. I share some of those big, epic fails that I've made along the way, and some of them I'm still making. Lately, I've been interviewing people and gaining their expertise and sharing that with you because ultimately, I really believe that the biggest factor in helping students develop a sense of ownership and self-direction, in truly empowering students to reach their creative potential, the biggest factor ultimately is the role of teachers. And so that's what we talk about on this podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about a real pain point for a lot of teachers, a real struggle. It can be a definite challenge. And it's this idea of collaboration and what it means to have students work in small groups on projects. How do we design our projects in a way where we can get the most out of creative collaboration? And if you're interested, check out if you go to this particular blog post that connects to this podcast, you will see that there is a sign up for a webinar. I'm doing a free webinar with my friend, good friend, Trevor Muir. Everybody always says good friend, right? Because you don't say like my bad friend, my mediocre friend. But he really is. He's one of my best friends, Trevor Muir. He wrote The Epic Classroom. He wrote The Collaborative Classroom, which I think is a fantastic book. And so he and I are going to be doing a webinar on this topic of, you know, taking collaboration to the next level. But let's go ahead and dive right into this topic. So I want to begin by sharing the critical role of creative collaboration. When Google began Project Oxygen, they assumed the best predictor of employee success would be the university program that their employees had come from and the grades that they had earned. To their surprise, though, the top of their list was being a good coach, communicating and listening well, possessing insights into others, including others' different values and points of view, having empathy toward and being supportive of one's colleagues. In other words, the most critical factor, or factors I should say, for success could all be wrapped up into this bigger idea of creative collaboration. Now later, when Google studied their teams, so not individuals, now they're focused on teams in something called Project Aristotle, they found that the top skills were equality, generosity, curiosity toward the ideas of your teammates, empathy, and emotional intelligence. Again, these were the skills most closely aligned to collaboration. Now, some people would call these soft skills, but as classroom teachers, we know that there's nothing soft about these skills. If anything, maybe we should call these hard skills or challenging skills or life skills because they are really hard to master. Unfortunately, it is all too common for students to struggle with these collaborative skills. And so I want to focus first on what happens when group work falls apart, especially within our project-based learning units. Now, we've all been there before as students. The teacher announces a group project and your stomach sinks. Ah, those dreaded words, group project. You start thinking through every single detail. You glance at the assigned group and try to determine just how much extra work you'll need to do in order to pick up the slack for the members who will do virtually nothing. Chances are you'll spend a few nights and weekends finishing random tasks only to see a shared grade at the end. You start thinking about all the different students involved. You'll have the drifter who's going to wander around the class talking to all the different students. You'll have that helpless hand raiser who's going to raise their hand and ask questions nonstop to the teacher. And you'll just want to get the work done, but they'll be asking, is this right? Are we doing it right? Are we doing it right? Are we doing it right? You have the feisty fighter who is going to be picking battles with every group member and trying to dominate the entire group conversation and, in some cases, stirring up drama. And meanwhile, you simply try to figure out how much extra time this is going to mean for you. You'll be working nights and weekends, finishing up random tasks only to see a shared grade that you all have at the end. In those moments as a student, it was frustrating, right? But looking back on it now, you get it. As a teacher, you recognize that it is hard to encourage full participation in group projects. You know that it's far more complicated. That the helpless hand raiser just might be feeling insecure. That the feisty fighter has leadership potential and they just don't know how to get there. And maybe that drifter wandering around has given up before they've even started because they are convinced that they have nothing to offer the group. On the other hand, you have experienced the positive side of group collaboration. You've experienced those moments where you and your team of fellow teachers are just in sync. Now, a boy band music is stuck in my head, but you're all in sync, right? With each member sharing ideas, adding a unique voice, and working hard to accomplish a goal. In these moments, you've engaged in true collaboration where the group is able to accomplish more together than they could ever accomplish individually. In these moments, group work does not feel like work. So how do we craft our PBL units in a way that encourages full participation in every group member? How do we ensure that every student is actively engaged in the collaborative process? Well, I think it actually helps to start first with why they might disengage. It could be insecurity. A group member is insecure and afraid of doing subpar work, so it's easier to give up ahead of time. After all, if the group shares a grade, this non-participating member might not want to get in the way of that final group grade, especially the student who might be aiming for an A. It could be low skills. A group member might not have the skills to do a particular task, and it's easier to let someone else with expertise handle it. If you think about the flow channel from flow theory, they have this idea of making sure that the skill level matches the task at hand, and if there's too much of a mismatch, it can create things like intense anxiety for students. It could be confusion. Students just don't know what to do. It could be unhealthy group dynamics. There might be unresolved conflict that needs to be addressed, but instead the group just moves on without resolving that conflict. It could be a lack of buy-in. A group member just doesn't have a sense of ownership. And so they don't really care and they don't really do much. It could be a lack of creative endurance. Some students just don't have the habits and sort of the perseverance to continue in creative work. They might be giving up way too early when things get challenging. So if we want students to engage in deeper, meaningful collaboration, we have to design our collaborative work in a way that will ensure that students are at their skill level, that there is buy-in, that the group dynamics are being taken care of and that there's trust being built into it, in a way that reduces confusion by creating structure, in a way that allows them to have a sense of voice so that they don't feel so insecure. So what does this look like? Well, I'm going to share four different factors for successful collaboration in PBL. Number one, ownership. When I first attempted project-based learning, I would create these hyper-detailed project directions. I wanted to make sure that every student understood exactly what needed to be done. if a student said, I'm confused, I responded by adding details to the original document. When a student would say something like, yeah, how many blog posts do I need to do? I clarified by tightening the parameters, not only on how many blog posts they did on their blog project, but how many paragraphs they needed to have. But then something strange happened. The students actually grew less engaged. I realized that they were working for me rather than working for themselves. I love this quote from about a decade ago from Chris Lehman, who writes, if you assign a project and get back 30 of the exact same thing, that's not a project, that's a recipe. And I love this because Chris is a leader who has guided his Science and Leadership Academy, the staff and the students. He's really empowered them so that PBL and inquiry-based learning and design thinking, they're a part of what they do. It's a part of the school culture. But I bring this up because that was my problem. I had created recipes with the best of intentions. This was often the case in doing things like science labs. I would walk students through every single part of the lab. I asked all the questions. I created the procedures. I knew exactly what the outcomes were supposed to be ahead of time. In other words, they never had an opportunity to own the process at all. Over time, though, I shifted toward this idea of student ownership. And the goal was to move from compliance, where students are doing something because they have to do it, to engagement, where they're doing something because they want to do it, to this true place of empowerment, where they have a sense of ownership in every part of the process. It's the idea of having students be self-directed in their learning. Self-directed is the notion that they are self-starters. They're getting started on the work all the time. They're getting it done on their own. They take the initiative, but they're also self-managers. They have the ability to self-regulate and to manage their tasks and to actually own the project management process. If we think about something like the launch process, which is the design thinking process I helped develop with my friend AJ Giuliani, every part of the process is built on student ownership. You have this beginning place of look, listen, and learn, where you're tapping into prior knowledge. Students are developing empathy on their own, and they are fully self-directed. They move into a place where they're asking questions. That's the A. And although you might provide sentence stems or sample questions, it's built on student questions. They are the ones creating their own questions. In Understand the Process or Problem, students are engaging in their own research. They ask the questions, they find the sources, they paraphrase the information. It's all on their own. They are the ones coming up with it. In Navigating Ideas, students are generating their own ideas and then they create their own project plan. In Creating a Prototype, students are not only creating on their own and making it on their own and using their own hands to design it themselves, they're also engaged in project management, where they are managing the project on their own as a group. And then in Highlight and Fix, students own the assessment process as they engage in self-assessment and peer assessment, including things like the 10-minute or 20-minute peer feedback system. So these are all built on this idea of student ownership. When we empower students to own the project process, we increase student buy-in. Students who might initially seem needy become confident as they internalize the reality that they are no longer working for their teacher, they're working for themselves, and often they're working for a larger community if they're going to eventually launch their work to an authentic audience. But I'll point this out, student ownership is not enough to ensure meaningful group collaboration. To take it to the next level, they also need to have interdependence. So that is the second factor right here. It's this notion of interdependence. I want you to think for a moment about the best group projects you've ever been a part of. Like, think outside of school, think outside of your amazing team of teachers you work with, just projects that you've been a part of. Maybe it's a band that you've been a part of and jam sessions that you've done together, or maybe you're one of those quirky, cool people who does improv and you've gotten to do improv with other people, or maybe it's a sports team that you've been a part of. Whatever it may be, think about the best collaborative projects you've been a part of. Often, these are the ones where the group creates something way more epic than any individual student could have created alone. Now, this is why I love interdependent structures. Too often in group projects, one member will work independently while other members are dependent on that single member, kind of filling in the gaps whenever they're being asked to help. However, when they work interdependently, each member is adding value to the group project. And that's significant. Interdependence begins with trust, something we'll talk about here in a moment. And it's this idea that you are depending on others and they are depending on you. It's this mutual dependence. But then there's also this built-in independence. You get to have your own voice, choice. There's personal accountability. You have a sense of autonomy. You're doing some tasks independently, but it's all contributing to the group. You can think about it as a Venn diagram, right? So on the left-hand side, you might have independent work. This is where you're just working by yourself. It's all coming from you. Then on the other hand, you have dependent work, right? Where you're depending on others for information. You're constantly like doing what other people tell you to do. And interdependent work is that overlap between the two. There's mutual dependence, but there's also mutual independence at the same time, which is part of why I love interdependent work. So if we think about interdependent work, one example would be the process I use for student inquiry. Here, each student generates questions independently. And then after that, they share all of their questions together. So notice there's that independence built into it, right? It's beginning with individual voice. You have your own autonomy. You're coming up with your own questions. But then students will work interdependently, and each member has a separate role. Member number one looks at the questions to see if they're fact-based. Member number two looks at the questions to see if they're on topic. Number three focuses on whether the questions are specific or not. And the goal is looking at all of the questions the whole group has created and saying, are these valid research questions? And then member number four is your quality control person. And so what happens is you can do this on chart paper or butcher paper, and each member has a different colored marker that they use. You could do this as a Google form, and you submit the questions anonymously, and then at that point, you can create three separate tabs next to the question, or three separate columns next to it with fact-based, on-topic, and specific. And then the members, you know, put yes or no for each part in that spreadsheet. However you do it, the goal is that each member has a role. And your quality control person, they're just kind of watching. They're the person who might normally dominate a group. They are, have a high skill level, a high drive, and they get to be a leader, but they also learn how to listen. They learn how to have empathy. They learn how to depend on other people, which is a critical leadership skill. They can also rewrite some of the questions that maybe aren't good enough research questions, and you're still leaning into their expertise. So the goal is that as we design collaborative projects, we create protocols like this where interdependence is built into it. The third idea is one that you've probably already seen so far. I've kind of alluded to it. It's the idea of structure. Although we want to avoid recipes in collaborative work, there's also a danger in doing this like total free-for-all in PBL, where you just say, here's the project, go at it, have at it, make it work. When you do that, it simply doesn't work. You need to have structures in order to facilitate creative collaboration. And so the goal is to make sure that you are designing protocols and structures where students still have a sense of ownership. They're also working interdependently, but at the same time, you've designed it in a way where there is structure built into it. It's the idea of having phases of a project. It's the idea of having deadlines. This is how people outside of school engage in creative work. I mean, I use the publishing process. I use the design thinking process. I use the scientific method. I use the academic research process. All of these processes are structures that we use. And structures should actually facilitate and inspire creativity rather than inhibit it. And then the fourth and final factor is trust. I've already kind of alluded to it, but you can have all three of those: ownership, interdependency, and structure. But if there's no trust, there's no collaboration. The best structures are going to incorporate all three of those elements in a way that seems seamless and interconnected, but you still have challenges in group work. Group members are going to fight sometimes. Students will have a bad day and simply not feel like working. Fear and insecurity are going to creep in. Because newsflash, we work with humans and we live in a messy, imperfect world with messy, imperfect humans. And because of that, there's going to be conflict and challenges. This is why I think it's really important that we build trust. So it helps to do something like having a structure or protocol for conflict resolution. I'm not going to get too much into that because this is really not my area of expertise. It can also help to have students negotiate group norms ahead of time. Some teachers might use something like a team agreement or even group contracts with commitments and consequences built into it. But the goal is to be able to develop trust so that students can give each other mutual feedback. I have a sketch video on the article that corresponds to this podcast. And in this, you know, I have this sketch video that explains the feedback and trust grid. If there's low trust and you have positive feedback, it's actually not positive feedback, it's flattery. If there's low trust and there's also negative feedback, there's hating, and the haters are going to hate. That's right, I just quoted Taylor Swift. But if there's positive feedback and positive trust, you have affirmation, and we all need affirmation. If there's negative feedback and high levels of trust, then there's critical feedback, and that's also necessary to help us grow. So I think it's really important that we have these structures that help facilitate trust. And then from there, we can do things like build additional trust with team building activities, a divergent thinking challenge, a show and tell activity. You can do this in hybrid classes, in blended classrooms. You can do this in distance learning if you're still in a distance learning environment. And groups can work interdependently. They can increase their trust and they can just get to know each other in a way that then allows them to truly collaborate on their projects. You can also do things like having peer feedback structures. You can do something like the 20-minute peer feedback system, where there's the elevator pitch, clarifying questions, feedback, paraphrasing, and next steps. You can do something like a mastermind group where each member is on the hot seat or sweet seat. They share their goals, they share their progress, they ask for feedback from other members of the group, and each member goes in a circle and shares how they're doing in this mastermind group. So there's a lot of different structures and protocols for peer feedback. There's other podcast episodes that I've devoted solely to how to do meaningful peer feedback. So I'm not going to get too much into that on this particular episode. But you get the idea. The more trust you have, the better your feedback will be. Now, I want to point out that trust, that ownership, interdependency, and structure are all really important. But ultimately, you have to have that last factor in terms of trust. Without trust, you will not have meaningful group collaboration. Even so, you can design for trust. You can design your protocols that build on structure and interdependency you can empower students with voice and choice. And even then, it will never go perfectly. Collaborative work will always be imperfect. But what you can do as the architect is you can design the structures that build creative collaboration for your students. It's not easy and it will never work perfectly, but ultimately it's worth it as you watch students develop lifelong collaborative skills that they will use forever. So the bottom line is we can be proactive and intentional in terms of how we design student collaboration. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you are interested in collaboration and creative collaboration, please check out the webinar that I'm doing with my friend Trevor. He wrote a great book called The Collaborative Classroom. I highly recommend it. Go check it out. If you are a school leader and you're interested in having your teachers engage in creative collaboration and design structures that fit into these four different factors, I do workshops and coaching and professional development on this. And so check out my speaking page. Go to spencerauthor.com. You can find it. And there's a little contact area and contact me and maybe we can make that happen. So thank you though for listening. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.